Last night I got 11 calls from my mother-in-law. She didn't know that she called me 11 times. She called and asked, "Hi, it's Mom. Where's Helene, my wife?" And I told her that Helene was in Oceanside with her junior high school friends, and that could have been disorienting right at the start of things, but that Helene is in Oceanside. And then 3 minutes later, my mother-in-law called back, and so it went throughout the course of the night. She has become what Kurt Vonnegut called unstuck in time. And she has a wonderful memory for everything that happened in the middle to distant past. She's still the family historian, but 5 seconds ago is gone forever. This moment is here, and she can smile, but it is gone, and she doesn't remember what happened in the present time, which is, of course, very troubling and painful for members of the family. Doesn't seem to be that troubling and painful for her, as long as she has a redial function. And even if I sound a little exasperated, like, "Ma, you just called 5 minutes ago," thank God she doesn't remember the tone of my voice when she calls back in another 3 minutes. So yeah, there are the blessings and the curses, but time is very different for her. And time is very different all of the time. I remember a beloved member of my previous congregation who had really a wonderful life and terrific children, only one of whom went bad and went into the Unitarian ministry. And but at the end of her life, a combination of cancer that had gotten into her brain and the medications turned her bitter and paranoid. And it was very difficult for her family to see that, to hear it, because there was some sense, and it's not right, but there's some sense kind of in death veritas, that people might reveal some deeper truths about themselves that they've been repressing. And it is just a sad fact that sometimes our ends are not pretty, and we don't get to have those wonderful scenes the way that they're portrayed on television and in the movies. And sometimes there is a moment at the end, or a week at the end, or a month at the end, that does not characterize or sum up the length of a person's life. I think this was first taught to me professionally when I had to do a very difficult funeral for a young man who was a drug overdose. And obviously, from the time of his addiction until the end, was very unpretty and very painful. And of course, you mourn for all that this person didn't experience and do, and all the laughter that he did not get to have, and all of the tears that he did not get to shed, and all of the great moments and experiences that are possible in a life that has length and breadth and days. But the last year did not erase all of the joy of his infancy, of his childhood, of his growing years. We are not summed up by an end. We are not summed up by a moment or a snapshot of a high point or a low point. We are the entirety of our lives and our experiences. Time is not one simple and single thing. In fact, I have very little idea of what time is, except that it is flexible. And we all know this. We all kind of understand that time isn't something that is real and solid and objective. Maybe we ought to get rid of our Western empiricism and just look at time as part of a flow and appearance as the veil of Maya. I'm not sure about that, but it's clear to all of us that relativity is a concept that everyone understands. Everyone in this room has sat through 20-minute sermons believing that they were an hour and a half. Hopefully not recently, and hopefully not today. Although I am always suspicious of people who shake watches. This thing running, time seems to have stood still. We must be approaching the speed of light. We've also understand that a vacation can count 2 weeks on our calendar and 20 minutes in our head and 5 years on our credit card balances before we get rid of them. And all of those are different concepts of time. Everyone of a certain age understands that time speeds up as we get older, that decades fly by faster than junior high school algebra class as we waited for that last tick of the pre-digital clock to go, oh, are we out of here yet? And now decades go by faster than that as our children and grandchildren age with stunning rapidity and our faces just get tighter and our hair redder, but that's another story altogether. We can stop time pharmaceutically, but only for a while. It's a very strange concept, time is. I was thinking about it, of course, because today is the day of the time change. How many of you got here an hour early? No one? Come on. Really? This is a first in my entire life and career. Okay. Testify. Testify, sister. Once upon a time, before our cell phones changed themselves, thus giving it's always a little strange, frankly. I got up this morning, my computer had changed itself, and I have some issues around that. They know too much. But in the old days, we used to actually have coffee ready for the people that showed up early because there were huge numbers that would show up early. And, of course, you would start the spring change about 20 minutes late as people kind of straggled in. It's a very interesting issue, time and time change. We gained an hour. And then we lose an hour. When the Julian calendar changed to the Gregorian and they lost a couple of weeks, people rioted because they thought that those weeks would be subtracted from their total allotment of life that God had given them. So I don't know how to spend the extra hour. Is it mine to spend? Time is all we have, and we don't really know what it is. There are biblical fundamentalists who will tell us by counting back the generations in the Bible and how long everybody lived, that Methuselah lived 900 years and Abraham fathered a child at 99, well at 100, 99 is when he had his circumcision. And you do all these biblical generations, and there's some fundamentalists who have decided that the world was created on Wednesday, October 13th at 3:47 p.m. Now, does that make any conceivable sense in the world? And the answer is, with all of my liberal acceptance of everybody's right to have their opinion, no. Not a bit. 3:47 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Jerusalem Reform Time, Eden Compensatory Time. What in the world does that mean? And it's not helped by the fact that I'm sure almost everybody in this room knows that Rosh Hashanah is the Jewish New Year, right? If you don't know that, raise your hand. You know that. But most people don't realize that on the Jewish calendar, there are four New Years. So when you start looking at those biblical ages, start dividing them by four. Because that changes it, and it turns out the creation wasn't at 6,332 B.C. It turns out when you shorten all those generations, it was actually 3 weeks ago. It's still 225 years is pretty impressive for Methuselah. But what this is about is the fact that our sense of time is really funny and really fuzzy. We can get our brains around the fact that it is, is that right, a quarter after 11 today. I didn't remember if I'd reset my watch. A quarter after 11 today here, but it's 3 hours ahead in New York. It's about 8 hours ahead in London. And across the international date line, it's already tomorrow. And I can't figure out why, if I call the international date line, I can't get the results of the New England and Colts game yet. But apparently I can't, because time is relative, but not absolutely relative. And though it's tomorrow, it's not exactly tomorrow. We deal with this stuff every day. And we're usually mostly comfortable with it. But time, as abstract as it is really all we have. It is the measurement that we use of our lives. And what are our lives in this relative and relativistic world of time? Is it something that's real, that proceeds from an alpha to an omega, a beginning, a middle, or an end? Is it, as I alluded to a couple of weeks ago, more like a DVD where there's random access and the memories that my mother-in-law lives in are as real as anything that we experience in our moments? Is it what sticks and what stays and what forms our character along every minute and every moment? Maybe we're just a gigantic computer simulation, as many science fiction writers love to posit. And maybe we're all just waiting for somebody to drop another quarter in and hit replay and get a chance again, the video version of eternity. If we are a video game, it explains a lot about theology. It explains why, kind of makes God as the ultimate nerd, the computer guy, who's trying to figure out exactly how to program the game. And if you actually read Genesis, well, if you read most of the Hebrew scriptures, but Genesis in particular, God is spending most of God's time going, "Foo, what was I thinking?" This infallible God is not represented in Scripture. God creates Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel, and immediately you get fratricide, and God saves Noah and his family, and immediately you get Noah planting a vineyard and getting drunk and passing out. God is always going, "What was I thinking in doing this?" So maybe it is a video game and we're still trying to develop it. But the bottom line in all of this is we are on this journey of time, whatever time means. A journey that involves change and confusion and concepts that are not solid and self-evident, but we have to work with them anyway. We live in an ebb and flow of life, and we don't always understand where we are, what we are, and where we're going. The famous physicist who wasn't Einstein, Werner Heisenberg, talked about how you can know something's location, or you could know its momentum, but you couldn't know both, because measuring one changed the other. But that is the great question in everybody's life. Certainly there are other wonderful and interesting questions. I would love to know where life comes from. I would love to know where it's all going. I would love to know all kinds of historic and scientific things. But the truly great personal questions that we answer not in our heads but with our lives is, wherever we come from and wherever we're going, whatever we are, What do we do now? In this moment that is not going to come again except in memory. And however real that memory is, it's not going to come again except in memory. What do we do now? What do we do when we look at our lives and ask the question that maybe can't be answered according to Heisenberg? Where am I and where am I going? Where am I in my journey of life? Where am I in the various stages of life? In Buddhism, they talk about stages, and the Buddhists talk mostly about the stages that men go through, but I think it probably applies to all genders, and that is the idea of going from warrior to householder to forest dweller. Where are we on our journeys towards wisdom? As we go through and test and try those various things that are appropriate to various stages of our lives, the warrior, the going out and conquering a world, establishing a life, establishing a career, chasing after all different kinds of joys and pleasures and experiences, and then the sense of responsibility as we become, whether partnered or not partnered, householders, people who are looking for some place that isn't moving too fast, some place to become centered, some place to bring in a sense of nourishment and meaning. And then as we release some of those things and start to do some more internal work in terms of who we are fundamentally, how has each moment of our lives contributed to our character, to who we are when no one is watching, who we are when we are with ourselves and deciding what to do in this moment and in the next moment, how we will take the next step in creating who we will become. Because we become who we are through our choices to act or not to act, to engage or to withdraw, to help or to impede. And every choice that we make, every moment that we take, every person whom we contact and into whose eyes and soul we look, whose hand we take, whose body we embrace, changes who we are in this moment and tomorrow and as long as we live. And that each act, each person has inherent worth and dignity, not simply because, as Unitarian Universalists, we say we believe in the inherent worth and dignity of people, but we have inherent worth and dignity because we are in a contingent relationship with one another. We know who we are by how we treat each other. We know if we are smart, if people treat us as if we're smart. We know that we have worth if people treat us as if we have worth. People who have a bad sense of themselves often did not earn that bad sense of themselves. It was given to them. It was imposed on them. When others turned their eyes, averted their gaze, walked away, closed down, were harsh and unwelcoming. We have such immense power with each other and in our world. And that immense power entails huge responsibility. I have no idea who I am without you. And I'm not talking about that as a job and as a church. I'm talking about that in a large sense, and it's true for everyone. Smart or stupid, handsome, pretty, beautiful, ugly, lovable, despicable. These are things that we learn about ourselves from each other. The greatest mirror that we have is not the mirror that we look into in the morning when we comb our hair, glance at when we brush our teeth. The greatest mirror is in the eyes and in the actions of those whom we encounter every day. It's a contract that we make with each other, and it's significant that we celebrate taking in new members today. It is a contract. We have to prepare a place in our hearts and in our lives and in the embrace of our compassion for people. For people who are strangers now and can be friends later. Because what we give in any social situation, even if it isn't returned in that moment, even if we are rebuffed in the moment that we reach out, it still counts when we open up our hearts. It tells us something about who we are. And we have to believe that somewhere along the line, the contract of emotional generosity is responded to. And we become, to a large but not to a complete extent, the people that we need to become, that we choose to become, and have chosen to become in every moment and every choice of our lives. Time is a passing thing, an ephemera. But just because it's an ephemera doesn't mean it isn't important. A lot of people misunderstand the book of Ecclesiastes that's usually translated as vanity of vanities, everything is vanity, saith the preacher. Well, this preacher doesn't say it's a vanity. The words in Hebrew are havel havalim. Havel havalim. Breath of breaths. Everything is but a breath. A breath is invisible most of the time in Southern California, anyway. A breath is not something that you touch, that you grasp, that you hold, that you can capture. But it is the animating principle of life. Just because it's thin and wispy, just because we can't grasp a hold of it, doesn't mean that it is not the value that we reinforce with every moment and in every breath. That's why we call it inspiration, to take in spirit and breath and life, and to take that inspiration and to use it to give spirit and breath and life to each other in every moment of this amorphous but real and precious time we spend together.